Is made possible with support from Verde Gallery, featuring Dia de los Muertos, a celebration of art, music, words, and dance. Starts October 25th and runs through December 4th. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom at 17 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired. Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution by Carl Weingartner in honor of his wife Allison on her birthday.
This is the Afternoon Magazine with your guest host, David Teal. Celeste Quinn has the day off. It's hard to believe that there was ever a time that people were unaware of the strange visitor from another planet who was faster than a speeding bullet and who fought for truth, justice, and the American way. Yet it was only 66 years ago, in the summer of 1938, that two young men introduced the world to Clark Kent and his famous alter ego, Superman. Their creation fueled the explosive growth of the comic book industry in the 30s and 40s and set the pattern for countless caped crusaders who live on in TV shows, movies, and video games. Yet for years, they felt they were never given their due and watched as others made mighty profits from their Man of Steel. A new book, Men of Tomorrow, Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the Comic Book, tells the story of these men and many others, most the sons of Jewish immigrants, who built a four-color empire and incidentally created a new artistic form. The noble superhero sprung from the hearts and minds of young dreamers, but he was initially funded by pornographers and bootleggers. Author Gerard Jones has dug deeply into the accepted version of comics legend, much of which was built around the self-mythologies invented by artists and publishers, and uncovered a secret history. Jones broke into the comic book industry himself with a 1987 humor series entitled The Trouble with Girls, and went on to craft adventures for Spider-Man, Batman, and The Incredible Hulk. He's written several books on pop culture and society, including Killing Monsters, Why Children Need Fantasy, Superheroes, and Make-Believe Violence. He joins us today by phone. Hello, Mr. Jones, and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure, and a very interesting book for me, at least, as somebody who's been reading comic books throughout my life. And, I mean, I knew some of the stories, but there's a lot here that I wasn't aware of.
Well, there was a lot I didn't know, and I was in the business for almost a decade listening to the old-timers tell the stories, and it was when I decided to put them together in a book, I discovered a lot of the most interesting stuff had not been told or was just sort of, you know, swept aside.
We're going to touch on that in a moment here. I want to just take a moment to give the phone numbers, so we'll be taking calls from listeners during this hour. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the area, anywhere in the U.S., you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. How did you first become interested in comics?
I was a huge comics fan in my early teens. I was one of those kids who lives for Marvel Comics. This would have been back in the early 70s. And I outgrew them, or thought I'd outgrown them, but then got re-intrigued by them in the 80s when they kind of the more oddball grown-up stuff started happening. The comic shops were appearing, and you got all these things like Love and Rockets and Mouse happening. And through a series of odd events, I ended up writing them. I did a satire series, like you mentioned, Trouble with Girls, which it's nice to know someone still knows about that one out there. and then started getting invitations from Marvel and DC editors to write the superhero comics, which was really fun. I was, 30 years old, and going back to these fantasies I'd had when I was 13, 14, trying to get them out there for a new bunch of adolescents. And once I was in the business, that's when I started to hear the stories of the kind of the Wild West early days of it.
Hello?
Have you lost me?
Oh, no, there you are. Okay.
There I am.
All right. Sorry, I thought that you drifted off there for a moment.
Oh, did I? Sorry
yes.
about that. I mean,
so, anyway, you talk about in the book about how a lot of what was kind of the accepted history of the comic book seems to be kind of the invention of the people who, you know, who were the writers and publishers and who were taking credit for the work of others.
That was an astounding, and even when not taking credit, just bending things around. One of the things I met Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster in the 80s when I was new to the business, and they were still going to comic shops. Those were the guys who created Superman and really created the superhero. You know, the superhero just seems like such a standard entertainment icon now that it's hard to remember that someone actually sat down and made this thing up. But Jerry and Joe were the guys, but even I discovered that the stories they told were distorted. Jerry talked about having sort of almost dreamed Superman, or having Superman springing full-blown into his mind one hot summer night and running to Joe's house the next morning and Joe scribbling it down and the Superman we know appearing full-blown in a moment. But I've then learned that Jerry, in fact, consulted with a number of other artists along the way, tried to get other people than Joe to draw it. And, in fact, there was an evolution of years in which Jerry was changing the idea and pulling pieces in from other bits of pop culture that somewhere between 1933 and 1937, the Superman we know evolved. And then Jerry claimed that he had essentially just been a naive kid who was rooked by the publishers and lost his rights to the character, but I found subsequently that he actually spent years battling with them and shooting himself in the foot, really. There's a whole story of Jerry Siegel trying to be the hustler, the operator, and trying to out-negotiate these tough guys who were publishing the comics, but continually digging a deeper and deeper hole for himself.
And, yeah, I mean, I thought that that's some of that story had been known, but I do remember hearing about Siegel and Schuster battling with DC over the years, mm-hmm. but certainly, yeah, there was a lot there that I wasn't aware of. How did you dig up all of this? I mean, if people were kind of mythologizing themselves and maybe unwilling to talk about the truth, how did you get this information?
I found one of the best things was to talk to family members. When other people have researched comics history, they've tended to take what the writers, editors, artists who've been interviewed say on face value. But I found that if you started to talk to the people who hadn't been interviewed, other pieces came up. Jerry Siegel, for example, this is one of the odd twists of this guy who created Superman. His father was shot to death in an armed robbery when Jerry was in his teens, and clearly this had a huge impact, that he was the baby of the family, and he suddenly lost his dad, and he was suddenly completely under the control of his mother, who was a very domineering person, and then he comes out with this ultra male, this bulletproof crime fighter. Obviously, there's a line to be drawn there, but Jerry never spoke of his father's murder to any of his coworkers or in any interviews. He always seemed to want to bury that psychological piece of Superman's origin. But in talking to members of the Siegel family in Cleveland, people who were outside the comic book loop and who had not been interviewed by comics historians, the story just kept coming up. It's a basic story of the Siegel family and sort of why Jerry was a bit of an oddball in some ways, but no one had really made the link to the creation of Superman. So it was just about getting outside the usual circuit. It's a funny field, and it's rather small. It still has a cottage industry feeling about it, and the history has mostly been told by diehard fans, you know, real superhero fans. And there's a kind of a protectiveness, as if the fans and the creators wanted to keep the real world at bay. And as soon as I stepped over that line and started to talk to the people who saw the real world in juxtaposition with the comics, all these stories started to come out.
Sure. One of the things that I was not completely aware of, I mean, I guess I on some level knew about some of this, but I was not aware to the extent that which the people who created the comics industry and the superhero were almost all coming out of the Jewish immigrant community.
Yes, it's astounding, really, that it really was a Jewish cultural form. That's been noticed a little bit. You have Michael Chabon's novel about Cavalier and Clay, mm-hmm. and Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, and so on, where he's doing that to an extent. But when you look at the realities of it, it's almost as if fictional versions don't go far enough. The business end, the printing, distributing, publishing, was almost entirely guys up from the Lower East Side, guys who had been mostly born in the old country and come over as kids, spoke Yiddish when they were kids, you know, very much of a in that Yiddish-American assimilation process. And the major creators of the superheroes, Siegel and Shuster, Bob Kane and Bill Finger, who created Batman, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, who created Captain America, were all born in the 19-teens, all born here in the U.S., but of the children of East European Jewish immigrants, and came up through the same sort of experiences at school and in the Hebrew lessons and just that, you know, that worldview. Mostly New Yorkers, but Siegel and Shuster were actually out of Cleveland, but still, you know, that eastern midwestern urban Jewish assimilation process, lower middle class. It was very, the fantasies are very much of that material. And Archie Andrews too. Archie was another Jewish creation, interestingly. You know, they were sort of mimicking this wholesome, waspy, what they thought of, I think, as American normality, but it was a guy named Vic Bloom who came up with them. So it's, you know, in the superheroes and in the comics, you can see these Jewish kids mastering and kind of reprocessing and reflecting back what they saw as the American culture they were trying to be part of, but also coming up with that, you know, very old and very distinct Jewish perspective.
One of the things that I found intriguing as well was that you seem to feel that the concept of the secret identity, which is so central to so many superheroes, kind of comes out of that Jewish background as well.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the secret identity concept, I think, clearly was relevant to everyone, because once Superman hit the stands in the summer of 38, it was as if every 10 and 11-year-old in America had been waiting for this and didn't realize it, because it was an immediate sensation, but I think it's particularly powerful to immigrants, to people like the Jewish kids who were very much interested in being parts of American culture, effective, successful parts of American culture, but also had that strong sense that you don't abandon your Jewishness, you don't cease to be a Jew, but you are a Jew and an American, and there's that taking off of the costume, you know, the Clark Kent. Well, Jules Pfeiffer, who worked in comics for a while, comic books, before he became a newspaper cartoonist, said that in his neighborhood, every kid knew Superman was a Jew, because who else but a Jew would come up with a name like Clark Kent? You know, this sort of almost parody of waspiness. And yet, what's interesting in the Superman secret identity, as opposed to, say, Zorro or the Scarlet Pimpernel or these earlier secret identities, was it wasn't Clark Kent, the regular guy pretending to be Superman to fight crime. Superman was the reality, and he put on Clark Kent as a costume. You know, Superman comes from another world, already super, and he pretends to be Clark Kent so he can mix with the rest of us. So if you're of this ancient tradition and of the chosen people, but you're functioning among Americans, you know, you're sort of putting on the American dress. And I think that was a very powerful symbol that I don't think Siegel and Shuster worked out consciously. They weren't particularly reflective or insightful guys, but I think they were feeling it. And I think their passion for that carried over to the creation. And I think kids picked up, because, you know, we all have that sense of, we have a great secret inner self, and we kind of have to play it down and pretend to be something less so that other people aren't threatened by it or don't run away from us.
The some of the modern incarnations of Superman, since John Byrne took over the book back in the 80s, and now even with the Smallville television series, that they seem to turn that on its ear, where Clark Kent is the reality and Superman is the myth.
Yeah, which is an interesting. I think there is a big cultural shift in the way that, even though the secret identity is still used in comics, there's a sense that the regular person isn't necessarily less than the super person. And there's even in the second Spider-Man movie, there's that moment where Spider-Man has just saved a trainload of people and his mask gets ripped off and all these strangers are looking at his real face, and there's that moment of panic, you know, oh my God, the secret's out, but then a kid says, don't worry, we won't tell anybody. And it's sort of just swept away. There's the sense that the secret self it's not so important to preserve the secret anymore. And the regular guy, the Clark Kent, can be pretty cool and pretty hip and pretty hot. And that's, I think there's a shift there in the way that the kind of the nerdy, geeky fantasies that gave birth to these superheroes are much more universal now. You can actually be pretty socially successful and proud of yourself and still plug into the superhero fantasy. So now, okay, you know, so what's the difference between Clark the Nebbish and Superman the hero? It's sort of, you know, it's about wardrobe at this point.
I want to remind listeners of our guest. We're talking to Gerard Jones. He's author of Men of Tomorrow, Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the Comic Book. The number to call us with your questions is 333-9455, or you can use our toll-free line at 800-222-9455. I wanted to get into the gangster portion of the book. Again, I think that's something that perhaps maybe people really didn't want to talk about. How is it that comics were initially linked to organized crime?
Well, that was another fun one to unravel, because from my early days in comics, people would hint at the seedy mob-related origins of the business. But it was all sort of a wink-wink, nudge-nudge. You know, it used to be a mob business. Will Eisner, the great cartoonist who does the graphic novels now, was said a couple times he never wanted to work for DC Comics because he heard it was too mobbed up and he didn't want to get mixed up with those people. But I thought, what does that mean? And that was another one where I found old guys who'd been in the distribution business who'd worked with Harry Donenfeld, the founder of DC Comics, and I could actually start to put the stories together. Harry's one of my main characters. Harry was a street kid, Lower East Side, hustler salesman, sold ladies' clothing before he went broke, and then got into his brother's printing business. So he was a printing salesman. He was out finding clients for his brother's printing presses. Right as Prohibition hit, and suddenly there was this multi-billion-dollar growth industry available to the seedier elements of urban American society. And Harry was perfectly positioned because he was buying paper from Canada to bring whiskey and beer down from Canada for Frank Costello's organization. Costello was one of those early guys. He and Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky and Benjamin Siegel, Bugsy Siegel, were young guys, you know, who had just come up out of the gambling rackets and other sort of marginal criminal operations and were suddenly becoming rich and powerful, moving booze in. And Harry was one of the people who moved alcohol in for them. And this gave Harry enough capital to become a magazine publisher. His passion was girly magazines. He wanted to do things like Artists and Models magazine and Spicy Stories and Parisian Humor, all these magazines that enabled him to put pictures of mostly naked chorus girls on the newsstands under the guise of not quite being pornography. And that was, you know, that was Harry's, that was, I think, the love of his life. The comics came later as an accident, but in the 30s, Prohibition was repealed. There were some anti-smut campaigns. Mayor LaGuardia in New York was trying to get the naughty magazines off the newsstands. And Harry was involved with that. Harry was also involved with the distribution of slot machines and things like that through Frank Costello. But Harry's gray eminence, his accountant and partner, Jack Leibowitz, a much more sober, sensible guy, was pushing for doing something more legitimate, less likely to enrage the censors. And the comic book just kind of appeared for them. They ended up picking up the distribution deal for this minor little thing called New Fun. But they saw that in the late 30s. They said, well, if we go with this kid-friendly comics thing, we're not going to be running into trouble. Harry almost went to jail over some nudity shots in one of his magazines, and I think that was the wake-up call. I think the moment Harry got arrested for pornography was maybe the moment the American comic book was born.
We have got a listener on line 4 from Bloomington, Illinois, with a question. Bloomington?
Yes.
Yes.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what the author's background was. I'm studying sociology over here at ISU, and it sounds sociological in nature.
There is some of that. I think it's a kind of a biography-cultural history combination, I guess. I thought I was going to be either a historian or a novelist when I was young, and I was going to college studying history, but then I dropped out of college just to be a freelance writer and found nonfiction pulling me more than the fiction. So I did, as I say, I wrote superhero comic books for a while, but mostly I've been interested in writing about American culture, American mass culture, you know, the things that we consume and don't take too seriously until later when we realize that there's, you know, they reflect who we were. There's some tremendous stories there. So what, call me a journalist, amateur historian, former comic book writer, would-be novelist? The truth is in there somewhere.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. What were some of the early influences on Superman for Siegel and Shuster? What came before Superman and what went into, kind of gelled into that design?
Yeah, it was an interesting amalgam. On the one hand, you've got Jerry Siegel, who's got his psychological connection, the death of his dad, from which I think comes the focus. The early focus on Superman is very much on his invulnerability. He gets shot, bullets bounce off, he gets stabbed, the knives break. You know, you've got that. But Jerry was also a science fiction fan. He was one of the first fans of what we would now consider science fiction. There was that, you know, there was the whole Jules Verne, H.G. Wells tradition. But in the 20s, the kind of techno-geeky, utopianist, pulpy, steamy science fiction was a new thing, and Jerry was one of the early kids into it, actually apparently published the first science fiction fanzine, and could therefore claim to have published the first zine, per se. He was wrestling with all these fantastic stories of spacemen and other worlds, and heroes who fought alien empires, you know, that stuff was in there mixing with his other issues. And then he also loved romantic heroic fiction. He loved the Scarlet Pimpernel, and he loved Zorro, and he loved Tarzan. So he had this concept in his head of the dual, you know, the sort of the dual life and the guy who rises up to fight for justice. Those pieces were there. And he liked the comic strips. He liked Buck Rogers. And I think maybe the other piece was a love of physical comedy, and that's something that doesn't get talked about much when people look at superhero origins, but that kind of wild, exaggerated, these acrobatic super stunts that Superman did early, just that joy in seeing somebody who can throw cars around and smash through walls, I think derives a lot from Jerry's love for the Popeye cartoons of the early 30s. And things like Douglas Fairbanks movies, the comedy swashbuckler. Jerry loved Fairbanks. And then the piece brought in by Joe Shuster. Joe was a bodybuilder. Joe was one of these extremely shy, quiet, nerdy young men who bought the Charles Atlas type magazines, the McFadden magazines about weightlifters. And he would go do the batons and the dumbbells in the privacy of his room and, you know, make himself big and strong without dealing with competitive sports, which he was afraid of. And Joe would draw bodybuilders. And back then, a lot of bodybuilding magazines, when the censorship was stricter, didn't show bare flesh. They showed men in tights and trunks. And you can see in the bodybuilder magazines of the early 30s that here's the Superman prototype. You just add the cape and the S, and the bodybuilder becomes the superhero. And it was that fusion, Joe's love of drawing strong men posing in tights, and all of Jerry's, you know, sort of fantastical fantasies that kept wrapping back around that moment of personal loss that fused together and turned out to be a very basic fantasy that still appeals to people.
Our guest during this hour of the program is Gerard Jones. He's the author of Men of Tomorrow, Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the Comic Book. You can call in at 333-9455 or our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. I mean, what do you feel, I guess, what was the appeal of the superhero for you, and what do you feel is the appeal for others as well?
Well, for me, it was fairly classic. I was 12, I think, too passive, rather depressed. One of these kids who's taught to be a really, really nice kid, non-confrontational, don't get in trouble, don't express your rage or your desire for anything, and which is tough as you're heading into puberty and you're heading into middle school. I was fairly isolated. But I discovered first the Incredible Hulk, the Marvel character that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby invented. It's about a nerdy scientist who, when he becomes angry, morphs into this gigantic brainless monster who runs around destroying things, but somehow always ends up on the side of the angels. That was a very powerful fantasy for me at that moment, that legitimacy of rage, that belief that these passions that I was repressing could actually be expressed and do some good was a very powerful fantasy. And that led from there to various other superheroes. But it was all about being, you know, feeling not competent enough to deal with the real world or grow up, and loving this fantasy of transformation, of being something big and strong. And I think that's a very common one. Although I've also found, I've done a lot of work with kids, also found there are kids who actually are angry and sort of over-expressive, have trouble controlling their impulses, who can be really drawn to the superhero concept because it shows them learning to channel their anger. The superheroes at that point become, you know, a way of collecting and focusing the anger in a sensible way, and in a kind of a pro-social way. And then there's others too, kids who've had insecurities, fear of abandonment, traumas, who love the superhero image of being invincible. They can be hit with bombs and still survive. They so often are almost defeated and almost killed in their stories, and then they rise up again. I think that's a significant one.
One aspect that you mentioned in the book too. I mean, I think there's at least a sublimated sexuality. Sometimes it's overt, but a lot of times it is kind of just under the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, how is that expressed early on?
That's there. I mean, that's from the beginning. It did become overt. Like Wonder Woman was overtly sexual early, until the publishers got the creator, the writer, to back down a little bit. He was a kind of a whacked out, disgraced psychologist named William Moulton Marston, who lived with two women in a menage a trois and was a bondage advocate and so on and so forth. And he kept trying to get these things cryptically into Wonder Woman, which makes him very interesting to read 60 years later, I have to say. But in the earlier stuff, well, if you look, don't know much about, say, Joe Shuster's inner life. This is the artist of Superman. But you look at a kid who was terribly shy, dated a few women in his life, but almost never had a second date, seemed to just pull away from women and sexuality, ended up just being a bachelor living with his brother late in his life, but dreamed of these muscle men, dreamed of Charles Atlas and Bernard McFadden and these weightlifters. Clearly there is a somewhat sexual fascination with the body. The desire to draw these men in tights has some sort of sexual turn to it. And he also drew, he loved to draw voluptuous, luscious women. The early Lois Lane was quite beautiful. And Joe obviously lavished a great deal of attention on drawing her. So there's that fascination, that love of the body combined with a tremendous social timidity that seemed to keep him out of any sort of intimate relationship. He never married, never had kids. So it's sort of that, you know, and you bring this to kids at the verge of adolescence, or you bring it to adolescents who maybe haven't dealt with these issues thoroughly yet. I think that ability to kind of celebrate the body in a way that both enables you to feel the presence of sex, but also not have to think about it directly, is pretty powerful. And I think these super beings in tights are ultimately very sexual, but they're also very pointedly not putting our faces in it.
One of the stories in the book too is about Bob Kane. Now, you know, and I found this intriguing because, you know, while you have Shuster and Siegel, who, you know, felt that they had been kind of screwed out of their money over the years, you had Bob Kane, who really, you know, retained control for the most part of his character.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it sounds like maybe he wasn't really all that involved in the creation of Batman.
No, Bob's an interesting guy. My initial sense of the book was I was just going to juxtapose the story of Harry Donenfeld and Jack Leibowitz with the story of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, Harry and Jack being the Lower East Side kids, Jack a fallen socialist, very practical businessman, Harry a guy who hung out with, you and Meyer Lansky and Frank Costello, and knew how, very much knew how the seediest aspects of the world worked. And then Jerry and Joe, these terribly shy, nerdy kids in their parents' houses in Cleveland making up this great hero. And the way they collided and Jerry and Joe ended up poor and obscure and Harry and Jack ended up rich. But I realized, I got to Bob Kane, and he had to be in there as a counterpoint, because Bob Kane was a guy, he was just a high school kid who was trying to make it as a cartoonist, selling a few cartoons here and there in the Bronx. But he kind of figured out how the world worked. His dad was a printer. He just had a little bit of savvy. And when the superhero boom hit, he immediately knew, his editor said, bring me another Superman type thing. And he came away with this thought of, let me do some sort of Birdman, some sort of maybe flying or seems to fly sort of creature. But he pulled on a friend named Bill Finger, a writer, and he said to Bill, help me develop this. I'll sell it. There should really only be one name on it, because things are more popular if there's just one name. And it'll all say by Bob Kane, but I'll make sure, I'll take care of you. You'll get what you deserve. And it was really Finger who, I think, developed the concept of the Batman more than Kane. But Kane went in, sold it, and basically never gave Finger the credit or the money that he deserved, and had a lifelong practice of hiring young artists desperate for work, getting them to do his drawing for him without credit, and then when they would, if they got good enough to move on, he would hire someone else. And essentially just ran a little studio, which in itself is not ignoble, except that he always pretended he was doing it himself. He would never say, I'm running the studio. This is all Bob Kane's work. And in fact, Bob couldn't draw very well, and actually never seemed to have a good idea in his life. But he knew how to get people who needed work and who needed to be in print and charm them. He was a very charming guy, very smiley, very likable. Charmed them into letting him use their work and keep his name on it, and he did very well. While Jerry Siegel was working for the Public Utilities Commission and Joe Shuster was delivering packages, and they were totally out of work in the comics business, Bob was still making a lot of money off Batman.
And of course, too, retained that creative credit, which Siegel and Shuster had to fight for back, in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was it's a really, I don't want to blow my ending on too much.
Okay.
It's an interesting twist. There's not, the Siegel and Shuster story looks like just this descent into misery for a long time, but as America's relationship with corporations and these concepts like intellectual property and creators' rights changed, Siegel and Shuster were able to take advantage of it and pull kind of a happy ending out of this.
Back in the 30s and 40s, I mean, now comics today are, I don't know, I'm not actually sure what comics today are seen as. In some ways, they seem to have kind of a mixed view out there in the public. But I mean, comics, the term comic book tends to be kind of a pejorative term, and mm-hmm. it's associated with kids. And now back when these were started out, there were a lot of kids reading, but there were a lot of adults too, yes?
Yeah, there were. Actually, what really made the comic book huge thing, I think, was the was World War II, when the GIs were on. I mean, you know, these are young adults, obviously, but there was a point where almost a third of all the printed matter sent to military personnel overseas was comic books. So it was a big thing among the GIs. And then when they came home, they kept reading them, and the business switched to try to keep up with them. The true crime comics were coming out, and then fictional crime comics, and increasingly gory, ironic, challenging horror comics were coming out, and romances. Romance was a huge genre with a steamy edge. I mean, these were really selling to young working-class women, not 10-year-old girls thinking about their first date, but really, you know, women who knew a bit about it all. And by the end of the 40s, about half the comic book readership was 20 and older. But the problem with, you know, since comics had begun at this sort of silly kid level, I think a lot of people still perceived that that's what they ought to be. And, of course, kids would buy any comic book, even a pretty gruesome horror comic. So in the 50s, there was a huge backlash against the more grown-up comics. Psychologists, there was a Senate committee that investigated comics as a cause of juvenile delinquency. Parents groups, the Catholic Church, and a lot of forces going after the crime and horror comics. And at that point, all the more adult stuff was pushed away, or just publishers just bailed from the business. And the little kid comic remained. It was superheroes and Archie Andrews and the Disney animals, essentially. And by the 60s, that's what comics were seen to be again. And there's still that tension will never go away between the comic book as little kid fantasy and the comic book as grown-up art or entertainment, and which in a way is a good thing. There's a strange productive tension that comes out of that. You get people wanting to do sort of dark, twisted reworkings of Batman, for example, which are very compelling. And then you get these sort of retro, you know, this return to early superheroes, which is can also be very compelling. So, you know, I like that duality, ultimately. I don't want it to be entirely resolved. Even in Art Spiegelman's work or Chris Ware's work, there's that tension between the kind of semi-literate, cheesy origins of the material with, you know, modern artistic and literary aspirations.
Who do you feel is the audience for comics today? And I'm just curious, too. I one thing I was unable to find anything about in researching this topic was sales figures for modern comics. In the old days, it was, you know, anywhere up to maybe 2-3 million. Comics.
Yeah, it was good. It's harder now because they don't use, well, I don't want to get into all the postal codes and stuff.
Right.
They don't have to print the print runs like they used to in the old days. You can actually look in the comics. Yeah, they were the more popular ones were selling 2-4 million back when Captain Marvel, Superman, Donald Duck. In the 40s, they were selling this well. Now, what I hear from people in the business is that a comic book can survive at maybe 10,000 copies, and if it hits 100,000, it's a big hit. It's a much smaller readership. It's funny because the superheroes that came out of comics and kind of defined comics do extremely well in movies and cartoons and video games. You know, in other media, they're doing extraordinarily well. But the people who actually buy superhero adventures in comic books are not numerous any longer. And, you know, and they're mostly adults, which is intriguing. I think the classic buyer of, say, a Superman or a Green Lantern comic book now is probably between 20 and 35 and got into them maybe in adolescence, but is really kind of recycling these earlier life fantasies and following these intricate, complicated plots, these convoluted continuities that they have now, whereas the more sort of, you know, the kids who are into superheroes are maybe watching Teen Titans cartoons, but they're not actually buying a comic book. And then on the other hand, you've got the so-called graphic novel. You've got the comic books also more overtly for adults. But I wonder if the readership of, say, Jimmy Corrigan by Chris Ware is actually any older than the readership for Superman. I think they may both be about 25 or 30, just different personalities, different reasons for liking comics.
Mm-hmm. We have a listener on line one from Champaign. Champaign, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, hello. You have a question for us.
Yes. You made the statement a little while ago that by the end of the 40s, there was a very large percentage of readership of comics that was over 20.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, where do you get that information? I mean, is there that kind of readership analysis available?
Yeah, they did. They were doing market studies by that point. The early going, in the late 30s, early 40s, nobody was doing any market studies, and it's very hard to piece together. You know, it was all based on what the publishers were hearing from their newsstand people. By the late 40s, some of the publishers, Dell in particular, George Delacour was a very successful publisher and distributor of magazines, who also created Dell Books and so on, and was in the comics business. And he was trying to take a sort of a scientific market analysis approach. approach to things. So by the late 40s, you've actually got surveys and breakdowns by gender, which is, and that's, you know, which is useful material to the historian, obviously. Interestingly, though, too, there were also studies being done by the anti-comics people, the National Organization for Reading Decency, which was a Catholic church group, was also trying to figure out who's reading these things and why. So you can kind of put those figures together.
Huh. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for your call. One of we talked a bit about the kind of the uproar during the 50s, but thought it might be worth just exploring a bit more while we have a few minutes. The most outspoken critic of comics was Frederick Wortham, and I wondered if you could maybe talk a little bit about him and about William Gaines, who had actually made the mistake of testifying before.
Yeah, it's an interesting and sort of a tragic conflict in a way, in that we were talking about the Jewish cultural roots of the comic book, and Bill Gaines, who published the EC Comics, was the son of Charlie Gaines, was actually named Charlie Ginsburg, who was one of the early publishers. He was partner of Harry Donenfeld. So, you know, it's a very small community. All these guys know each other or are related to each other. So you've got that, you know, New York left-leaning Democratic Jewish bunch of guys, working-class guys, running the comics, and Bill Gaines was doing the horror comics. And then Frederick Wortham, who was a German Jew, also left-leaning, very concerned with kids, concerned with the quality of American culture, who saw in the comics everything he hated. He thought that the comics were teaching kids to be criminals, inspiring juvenile delinquency, and there's this incomprehension, you know, these up-from-the-streets guys with their way of looking at fantasy, which is you give people what they want, and you put the seedy fantasies out there if that's what intrigues people, versus this academic approach, but both coming from kind of the same cultural and political background. And that was Wortham's ideas was you have to manage mass culture in order to teach people to behave well. And it's still a conflict that goes on with the media. And the video game business is getting the brunt of most of it now. But unfortunately, the Bill Gaines, young whippersnapper, upstart, thought he was going to go testify to the Senate and show up Senator Kefauver and Dr. Wortham and make a great case for comics, but was just destroyed in his testimony. He's sort of like Jerry Siegel thinking he could out negotiate Harry Donenfeld. These guys who are kind of puffed up with their nerdy fantasy lives, and they think they can go out in the real world and defeat these people who have been doing this for decades. And you can't be just a nerdy comic book publisher and think you're going to outsmart a whole panel of senators who've been ripping people up professionally for years. And it was a sad moment for comics, but it's certainly an interesting story to piece together.
Ultimately, he has kind of the last laugh, in a sense.
Well, yeah, because they, EC Comics got killed, but he turned his mad comic book into a black and white newsstand magazine that sold far better than a comic book, and really kind of redefined American pop culture as the publisher of Mad. So he didn't complain. I mean, no one who was canny, no one who was clever at making things work, lost out, really. You know, Jack Liebowitz got into the magazine industry. You know, DC became a comic book publisher and a distributor of Signet books and Playboy and Mad magazine. So, you know, they knew how to flow with the times. But it's the poor guys like Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster who could not deal with the rules changing on them until their 60s when they finally started to get some help.
Well, I am afraid we're going to have to leave it there, and I would love to keep going because I think this is a really interesting subject. But I want to say thank you, Mr. Jones, for being our guest today.
Well, thanks for having me. It was great.
Our guest during this hour of the Afternoon Magazine was Gerard Jones. He's the author of Men of Tomorrow, Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the Comic Book. It's available in hardcover from Basic Books. You can find out a lot more about Jerry Siegel, Joe Shuster, and the whole gang in that book. Executive producer for the Afternoon Magazine is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Henry Frain. You're listening to WYLL AM Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Illinois. Next up is Todd Gleason with the settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade.
Thank you very much, David. From the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange this afternoon, we'll go through all the settlement prices. Let's start at the Board of Trade. We're in the bean pit. Futures were off 10.5 cents in the March contract. The January was down 9 cents. Most of that on a technical sell-through from Friday's week closes and the weekly close, which was down last week on Friday, too. Of course, last week, a short week in very light volume, and those closes can be extended just because of the light volume. Although last week, as we take a look at them, beans in the January contract on the weekly trade were off 2, and the beans were off, and the November contract was off 3. A lot further than that today, and we'll have to check and see what the volume was like. We'll talk about that with Kurt Kimmel this afternoon during the closing market report. That comes up at 6 after this hour. Let's begin where we always do for the Chicago Board of Trade. High, low, and settlement prices in the wheat pit today. December contract down 4.5 cents in the wheat, had a high of 292, a low at 286. The settlement price there at 287. The March contract at 304 high, low at 298.5. A settlement price at $3.5, off 2.5 cents. And the May futures in the wheat pit, a 311 high, low at 305.5. Settlement price there at 306.5, down 2.75. July futures 318.5 high, low at 312.5. The harvest month settled at 313.25. They were off 3.5 cents. And September futures were off 3.5 too. They finished the day 324.5 on the high, the low at 321, and settled on that low. Once again, the September wheat futures were down 3.5 cents for the day. From the corn pit now, the nearby December contract trading to a high today of 196.5, a low at 192.5, and a settlement price at 193.25. And they were down 3.75 for the day. The March futures 207.5 high, low at 203.75, settlement at 204.75, up 2.25. And the May corn 214.5, the high, the low at 211.25. Settlement price at 212.5, and they were off 2.25 for the day. July futures 222, the high, the low at 219.25, and a settlement price at 220.25. They were down 1.75. And the September corn 230.5, the high, low at 227.5, and a settlement price at 227.75, down 2.25 for the day. December futures in the corn pit 239.5, the high, the low at 237. A settlement price at 237.5, and they were off 1.75 for this Monday afternoon. December oats now. The high today, 153.5, the low at 148, settlement price at 153.75, or rather 153. They were down 3.25. Once again, December oats, 153, a settlement down 3.25 for the day. The March oats, 148.75, off 1.5. Had a high at 149, a low at 147, settlement price at 148.75. January soybeans, 544, the high, low at 535, settlement price at 539.5, down 9 cents. And the March contract at 546 high, low at 537.5, settled at 540.75. They were off 10.5 cents for the day. May futures 544, the low, the high at 553, settlement price at 546.25 in the beans, down 11.5 cents for the May contract. July futures now 561, the high, low at 552, settlement price 553.5, 11.75 lower. And the August soybeans at 558 high, low at 555.5, and a settlement price at 556.5. They were down 12 cents for the day. September contract off a dozen as well. 564 the high, the low and settlement price both at 559. Once again, the September beans were off 12 cents. That's for next year at a settlement price of 559. December bean meal now, 160.50 the high, the low at 156.60, settlement price at 156.90. They were off 430. And the January contract off $4.10 with a high of 161, a low at $158.10, and a settlement price at 158.20. December bean oil, 20.55 the high, the low at 20.03, settled 20.27. They were off 47 cents. And the January beans, bean oil that is, 20.70 the high, the low at 20.15, a settlement price there at 20.47, and they finished down 41 for the day. Now the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. The nearby January feeder cattle today up $1.15 with a settlement price at 104 and a nickel. The high, $104.50, the low at 103.30, a settlement price once again for the nearby January feeder cattle at $104.05. They were up $1.15 for the day. The March feeder cattle, $100.60 the high, the low at $99.35, a settlement price at $100.25, up 117.5. And the April contract at $99.35 high, the low at $98.45, settlement price at $99.15 a hundredweight. They were up $1.37.5 today. from the live cattle pit. The November contract did not trade. Of course, it's not trading at all. December contract, a high today of 90.22 and a half for the settlement price, and it was up 2.5 cents. The high at $90.25, the low at 89.67 and a half, and a settlement price at 90.22 and a half for the December live cattle. Once again, they were 2.5 cents higher. And the February live cattle, a 90.22 and a half high, low at $89.60, settled at $90.12 and a half cents, and they were up 15 cents for the day. From the lean hog pit, the nearby December contract, 77.60 the high, the low at 76.40, settlement price at 77.35, and they were up 47 and a half cents for the day. February lean hogs, 76.17 and a half the high, the low at 75.10, settlement price there at 76.10. And they were up 82.5 cents for the day. April contract, a 73.35 the high, the low at 72.50. April lean hog settled at 73.22 and a half, and they were up 67.5 cents. The May contract, a 72.32 and a half high, low at 71.50. Settlement price at 72.30, up 87.5 cents. Speaking of the livestock, we'll hear a story this afternoon from last week's commodity conference where most of the commodity groups in the Illinois Agricultural Association were represented. The corn growers, the soybean association, the pork producers, and the beef association, along with the wheat association, were all represented last week on Tuesday at the Illinois Commodity Conference, and they took up livestock in the state. Most of them would like more livestock to be produced in this state. As you'll hear later this afternoon, just 8% of the corn that is grown in the state of Illinois is actually fed to livestock in the state of Illinois. 19%, by the way, is fed to livestock in other states. So we'll take that up later this afternoon during the closing market report, which comes up in just a few minutes at 6 after the hour. The bellies for the day had a high of 102.47.5 at the Mercantile Exchange. Your last set of numbers for the day, 101.25 the low, the settlement price at 101.70, and they were down 17.5 cents. Let's take a look now at the local forecast for Urbana-Champaign this afternoon. Cloudy, some light rain. This from Ed Kieser, chief meteorologist here at WILL. The high near 40. Winds out of the east at 6 to 12 miles an hour. Tonight it'll be cloudy with some light rain. The low of 34. Winds out of the northeast at 6 to 12 miles per hour. Tomorrow it'll be cloudy. Some periods of light rain. The high near 40. Winds out of the northeast at 5 to 10 miles an hour. And tomorrow night, cloudy. Some rain changing to snow before ending toward daybreak. The low near 30. And Wednesday it'll be mostly sunny. The high near 40. That's a look at the near-term forecast for the local WILL area here in Champaign County. Well, stay with us all afternoon here on WILL AM 580. This is the WILL AM 580 Agricultural Information Advantage, a broadcasting service at the College of Communications here at the University of Illinois. And we're glad that you